From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in January of 2012, just days before the Iowa caucuses 4 years ago. Liberal writer Kevin Drum wrote a piece about corn-based ethanol, and he blamed the Iowa caucuses for forcing more subsidies for ethanol down the throats of taxpayers. Here's what Kevin Drum wrote about the practice of growing corn to be used for energy in January of 2012. Quote, "Corn ethanol is catastrophically idiotic. Corn ethanol, it turns out, is actively worse for the environment than even gasoline. Farmers have responded to the subsidies by reducing the amount of farmland used for food production. That has driven up the price of staple food worldwide. And back when the subsidies were enacted, corn farmers were already doing pretty well. So now we're shoveling $10 billion in ag welfare to a group of people who are already pretty rich. In fact, corn ethanol subsidies are such obviously bad policy that it's one of the rare areas that both liberals and conservatives agree about." End quote. And very harsh. Well, here we are in 2016. Subsidies for big ag remain popular in Iowa, and so they remain popular with most presidential candidates. But what if science could fix some of the problems Kevin Drum just described with corn-based ethanol? What if we could make ethanol that was more efficient, or energy more efficient, not as corrosive for automobiles, better for just about everything? It's our monthly science roundtable, and my guests have been working on essentially doing what I just described, improving this process, making it more efficient, making it what we all hoped it could be 10 or 15 years ago. We're about to find out how as we explore the potential future for ethanol, butanol, and energy. Let me welcome my guests, and Dr. Bill Jones. Bill Jones is a professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester. Nice to have you here.
Good afternoon, Evan.
And on the line with us is Dr. Tom Baker. Tom is a professor of chemistry at the University of Ottawa. And Tom, nice to have you as well.
Thank you very much.
Tom, is corn-based ethanol getting a bad rap, or was Kevin Drum right about a lot of what he wrote 4 years ago?
Oh, I think he was definitely right. I mean, the using food for fuel is what we call the first generation of biofuels, because obviously it was something that was done because they could do it, rather than it was necessarily the right thing to do. I mean, we had to have an oxygenate addition to our fuels that was mandated by the government, and this was what was available at the time. I think now we really want to go to using the waste products from agricultural products, you know, such as the corn cob, the corn stover, the corn husk, et cetera, as opposed to the actual starch from the food.
Well, we're going to get into that, because this is actually, even though it's a sort of a wonky subject this hour, this is important, and this impacts a lot of people, and it's exciting to me. I had kind of mentally checked out on corn-based ethanol, not only reading the work of people like Kevin Drum, but Kent Gardner from the Center for Governmental Research right here in Rochester. He's been a longtime critic of corn-based ethanol, and now here we are looking at a way to make this much better. You know, Bill, I was out there in Medina when Governor Pataki at the time was rolling out the plans for this new corn ethanol plant, and what did they talk about? They talked about better for the environment, more energy efficiency, less reliance on foreign oil, and, you know, they thought pretty good for the cars, too. I want to work backwards. There is a corrosive effect for an automobile, yeah?
Well, yes. Ethanol is a fuel. It can burn on its own. You light it, you'll see the flames. It doesn't produce as much heat as gasoline, so it's not as good of a fuel in terms of desirability for a transportation fuel. However, ethanol, as you also know, will mix with water readily. You can mix it in any proportion, and that allows water to be drawn into the fuel, the ethanol fuel, as it's used in combustion engines. That water is corrosive for all the reasons we know. It causes rust. It causes degradation of the metals and plastics sometimes that are used in the engines. So these are some of the negative things that go along with using ethanol as a fuel or incorporating it into an existing fuel.
Did we overpromise? Did government overpromise on corn ethanol 10, 12 years ago?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. I think it has a lot of, at the time, as Tom mentioned, it's available. We can make it in mass quantities just by straight fermentation reactions. So I think the reason it's used now is because of that. You'll remember also for a while they used another additive in oxygenating, methyl T-butyl ether. It was used for a number of years, but then was removed from the fuel chain because that particular chemical, when mixed with gasoline, had some other undesirable properties. Namely, if there was a gasoline leak, then that gasoline would mix with the water system in the environment and get into drinking water. So they've phased out the methyl T-butyl ether as an oxygenate additive.
And we've had listeners who saw what we'd be talking about in our monthly science roundtable this morning. One who emailed me to ask, wait a second, aren't I seeing that E10 sign still at the gas station? Is ethanol still at every gas pump here in our area?
Pretty much. I watch for this as I drive around and fill up. And it's rare to find a station now that will deliver pure gasoline without ethanol added at the 10% level. So I think the answer to your question is yes. Probably 95% at least of our local gasoline has 10% ethanol in it.
And we've been kind of talking about some of the negative effects. What's the benefit, I guess, now for staying with E10 that we see?
Well, one thing is we're using 10% less gasoline by using 10% ethanol additive. That ethanol is a bio-renewable source. It is not coming from unreplenishable oil. We can grow and make plants that will be then used to produce ethanol. And that's the real draw for me about ethanol as a fuel or as an entry chemical into fuels is that it's biorenewable. It is not based on the limited amount of oil that lies beneath the ground.
And Tom Baker, when it comes to the impact on the environment, I think what maybe was, I don't want to say missed, certainly we knew what could happen when government really started heavily subsidizing corn-based ethanol a number of years ago. But what I think we have seen, at least from what I've been reading, is that a number of farmers decided, well, there's a lot of money there, and they stopped rotating crops. And you know, I didn't grow up on a farm, but I have family who did, and they tell me if you're not sort of rotating crops, that some of the benefits that Bill just described, that, okay, well, it's 10% less gasoline, it's a potentially renewable source there, but it starts to have a negative impact if the farmer is incentivized not to rotate, impact on a soil. Is that fair, Tom?
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. obviously, the quality of the soil really benefits from crop rotation. And this has happened before when people were convinced to leave tobacco and go to say soybeans. People had to wonder about how do we do that properly and manage the health of the soil when we're doing something like that. And as you said, when ethanol became kind of a windfall because of the subsidies, a lot of people tended to just stress the soil by growing corn more and more and more and more.
All right, so
there's no doubt that was an issue.
So let's work through some basic definitions before we start really kind of diving into the science of what's happening now and what may be coming as a result of this research. So let me just ask Bill and Tom to start working through the definitions. We talk about ethanol or corn-based ethanol, but let's go ahead and actually define what it exactly is. Bill?
Okay, so ethanol is a two-carbon organic molecule, two carbons and one oxygen. It also has hydrogen, three on one carbon, two in the middle carbon, one on the oxygen at the end. So it's a combination of two carbons, one oxygen is the basic core of the molecule.
Okay, and it is corn-based ethanol. It is a food product or foodstuff used for energy purposes now. I don't know how long we've been doing. Yeah, any idea how long we've been making corn-based ethanol?
Ooh, I don't have the answer, but it's been a while.
Yeah. Okay. And Tom, now let's talk about what butanol is, and I'll ask Tom for a definition there.
Well, butanol is just is like ethanol, except it has two extra CH2 groups in the middle of the chain, and so it tends to look more like gasoline, which is we can think of gasoline as just an infinite number of CH2 groups. So this has now more CH2 groups versus the oxygen, which makes it a better fuel,
so,
a higher energy fuel, and also a fuel that's more compatible with the kind of things in our engines, like the seals and such that are in our engines that are used to working with these hydrocarbons.
So, Tom, here's one of the many ignorant questions that the host has this hour. Well, how come we don't just see much more butanol than in use these days?
Well, I think one of the problems we have with butanol coming as a renewable resource is that when we do the fermentation process to produce butanol, which is actually an ages-old a process called the ABE process, or acetone, butanol, ethanol process. And so when you take these sugars and ferment them, they tend to make those three different chemicals, acetone, butanol, and ethanol. And when you breed the microbes to make mostly butanol, when you start to get high concentrations of butanol in your fermentation broth, it tends to kill the microbes. And so you can't really build up a large concentration of the butanol using the fermentation process. And so that's a limitation from trying to use the fermentation to just make butanol.
All right. So, Bill, work us through what kind of research has been going on, where kind of things stand now, when it began. Take me through this process now.
Okay. So Tom and I are both members of an NSF, National Science Foundation, funded center, the Center Enabling New Technologies Through Catalysis. And this center funds research on an annual basis to encourage researchers to do basic work to discover new processes that might be related to the chemical industry or to the environment or even to fuels. And Tom had seen some articles on the conversion of ethanol to butanol that were published in the past few years, and he shared them with me and suggested that we design a project of our own to try to go after this target, that is, converting ethanol to butanol. And so we started this project about a year ago, and we're able to get the funding through the center that I mentioned, and fortunately we got some pretty interesting results right off the bat.
Such as?
Well, the first thing we found is we already had a way to take ethanol to one of the intermediates that we needed, acetaldehyde. And the key discovery was a postdoctoral researcher working in my lab found that with a specific metal base, that is, it was using nickel hydroxide as the base, he could selectively convert the C2 acetaldehyde to the 4-carbon part of the butanol that we needed. And he was able to do that very selectively. And by that, I mean he got only the 4-carbon chain from the 2-carbon chain and no other byproducts.
Were you surprised at this development?
Yes, because every other example, if you go and look in the literature where people had tried to do this process, they get not just the C4 products, they would get C6, C8, and they would get what are called isomers, which means instead of being a straight long chain, the chain would have branches in it along the way, and therefore they would get a mixture of products. With the discovery of the nickel hydroxide that I mentioned, we were getting very selectively conversion of the ethanol to the butanol. And that was the key discovery that we made.
Tom, can you want to characterize your reaction to that discovery?
Yes, well, it was really surprising. It's one of those things that once you see it, you can go back and say, oh, yeah, that makes sense that if you make this one step of the reaction have more kind of spatial constraints, perhaps you can reduce the byproduct reactions. But it's not something that we came up with on our proposal, for instance.
Yeah.
So it was really a very nice idea.
Well, and
that the postdoc had, and in science we have lots of ideas, but not all of them pan out to be quite as exciting as this one.
You want to add something there?
But yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the case. Here, the person working on the project, we had a known pathway we wanted to follow, and he tried a typical base, sodium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide. These are common bases that you would find in a laboratory. And these gave the same results as what everyone else had seen previously. Low selectivity, a mixture of products other than just butanol. But he just happened to be working with this nickel hydroxide for a totally different project and said, that has a hydroxide as well. It could act as a base, and it's sterically very crowded. Let's try that. And when he did, that's what led to the Eureka discovery.
I mean, does he call you over and say, Bill, you might want to see this. What's the moment?
Absolutely. And the key is what we call the GC trace, the gas chromatography trace, which shows on a linear plot the different peaks of the different materials. And when you look at one of those, you'll see a peak for the ethanol, and you'll see a peak for the butanol. And typically you'll see a half a dozen other peaks for all the other impurities that are formed. When Shumit, my postdoc, came over and showed me his GC trace, it showed just the ethanol and just the butanol product, nothing else. As far as we could examine it, we could see no other byproducts. So that was a pretty exciting result.
My guests are talking about their work that relates to the future of energy and a more efficient way of converting ethanol, which could lead to better and more efficient alternative fuels here. Bill Jones and Tom Baker are with us here. Bill is a professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester. Tom, a professor of chemistry, on the line with us from the University of Ottawa. And the media has to, you know, we always have to be careful when we talk about research in process, et cetera, whether it's on the medical side and often on the medical side. You know, are we moving towards a cure for this or a biomarker for X, Y, Z? Because early results can be promising and the media wants to, we want a headline. I want to be able to say, you guys cracked the code for energy that could make what we put into our cars or what we help power our world with much more efficient. And Bill, you'd probably tell me, don't get ahead of yourself. Is that what you would tell me?
Yes, this is the preliminary discovery. There's a lot that needs to be done to make this, like you say, something that would change the way we produce energy or produce fuels. There's no doubt that the butanol would be a favorable product in terms of its physical properties and its fuel properties. It's also as value as a chemical in itself, as part of the chemical feedstock that the chemical industry would use as well. So it's a very, we call it a value-added product. The discovery we made of getting that selectively means that you don't have to do a separation step after you make the butanol. And again, that adds value to the product. To bring this to market, though, what's really going to have to happen is to make the process longer lived. That is, we have a catalyst that works for about a day and then it stops working. So we need to find out why it's not working any longer and find out if we can shut down these pathways that prevent it from working.
Okay. Tom, when it comes to bringing to market, then my understanding is you have some industry experience that could help at least bring some light to what this process might be like. Is that fair?
That's true. I worked both in the chemical industry and also in the American National Lab System before I came back to Canada to be an academic. The exciting part for us now in the ethanol area is to make the ethanol from the agricultural waste. And so there are three plants now that have gone into operation in North America. And this is a big deal because it's a difficult time for biofuels right now, both because of the shale gas revolution we're seeing in North America and, of course, the very low oil price. So both these are working against the biofuels industry, which is a fledgling industry trying to succeed with renewable resource feedstocks. But DuPont is involved. This company, Stora Enso, is involved in these large demonstration plants in Iowa and Kansas right now that have just begun operating last year. And so, when you start to think about using the ag waste to make the ethanol, and then having a chemical process where you could take the ethanol to butanol, it starts to look a little more reasonable if you can get the very stable catalyst that the Bill was referring to.
What does the industry, for lack of a better question, what does the industry want? And, you know, some might be listening to this saying, well, how come 10, 15 years ago when subsidies were really riding high and all this promise was happening and these new plants were rolling out, how come teams weren't trying to crack this kind of code and move to a much more efficient model? You know, is the industry interested in that, Tom?
Well, they've actually been, you know, it actually took a decade to figure out how to make ethanol efficiently from the waste instead of the starch. So the starch to ethanol, the corn starch to ethanol, was actually something people could do. But actually taking it from the lignocellulosic biomass was a much more difficult problem. And so that's why we're only at the demonstration plant stage, because it's taken the biochemists, the chemists, the chemical engineers, more than a decade to try and get this to a commercial process that is going to be viable.
And, You mentioned shale gas, Tom. Can you just elaborate a little bit? You talk about the impact right now of different energy sectors, and shale is obviously sort of having its moment, even though it is controversial, and New York State is not on board with that. Pennsylvania, many other states are. What's the impact of shale gas as you see it? Elaborate a little bit more on the impact there.
Well, the shale gas has had multiple impacts across a lot of different sectors. So for the chemical sector, it's had a very positive impact for North American chemical companies. When you make the energy cheaper, then it it costs you less to make the chemicals, and so the North American chemical companies were very much riding high the last several years as a result of this inexpensive energy. Now, of course, that changes when the oil price goes down, because then all your demand also goes down. And so now they're struggling again, because of other. One of the advantages to bio-based resources is that you're not always at the mercy of a volatile hydrocarbon pricing market. So the problem we have with hydrocarbons isn't just that they're unsustainable and their combustion is leading to higher CO2 levels. It's also the fact that we never know what the price is going to be. And so if you're a consumer products manufacturer, how can you guarantee the price of your product and the quality of your product when your feedstock, could wildly change its price? And so this is why we really want to use the resources that were given in North America, of all the agricultural waste and all the renewable trees that we could grow, in order to really make sustainable feedstocks for the chemical and manufacturing industries.
Listeners, I've got a number of questions coming in via online sources, and we're about to start posing those to our guests here. But if you want to call the program, you can do that as well. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll-free on our monthly science roundtable, 844-295-8255. Or if you're right here in Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Jake writes to the program and says, well, we're stuck with it, so I guess using ethanol optimally is a good idea, but every biomass hydrocarbon is nothing more than a bridge fuel. Wouldn't the research dollars be better spent on, say, battery technologies, solar, wind, etc., meaning non-carbon-based renewables? Bill?
Well, I think some research dollars are being spent on those, and I think that's exactly...
You're saying we're walking and chewing gum, is what you're
saying. Yes, and I think that's a good thing to do. I think we should be researching better battery technologies, new fuel cell technologies. We need to do it all. I don't think it's a matter of putting all our eggs in one basket and only doing one thing. But certainly from my point of view, improving ethanol by taking it to a value-added chemical like butanol, not just for fuel sake, but also for chemical sake, is really a step in the right direction.
Okay.
It is producing organic chemicals from renewable sources.
Tom, how would you answer that question?
Well, I think, I would agree with Bill in that we need to do everything that we can. But we also have to realize that the transportation fuels are different than our energy generation. We're doing a pretty good job at being able to diversify our power generation. We can use wind. We can use solar. We have a lot of options. When it comes to transportation fuels, our options are much less. We're looking at hydrogen, we're looking at batteries, but it's hard to think of batteries being good for the truck who's driving from Seattle to Miami, for instance. And so, again, we're going to have to diversify our solutions even for transportation, and that's something that we need to do more thinking about and develop more technology around.
Sue writes to the program and says, does this still leave us with farmers who are overplanting and overemphasizing corn? Bill?
I'd imagine the answer is yes. I don't know that for sure, but with the subsidies, I think that's probably an accurate statement.
Okay. Tom?
Well, we've worked hard over, or scientists have worked hard over the last decade to learn how to take corn waste and turn that into ethanol. There's no reason that we couldn't take other crop wastes and turn them into ethanol as well, because they're all built of this lignocellulosic biomass. And so there's a lot of similarities in the waste that we could get from soy or from wheat or from all kinds of different crops. So it doesn't necessarily put us in the corner of only growing corn. As we expand into the lignocellulosic ethanol regime.
All right, James, and other questions that have come in, we're going to get to that in just a second. Let's get our short break in, and we're going to come back with our monthly science roundtable. My guests, Bill Jones in studio, professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester, and Tom Baker, a professor of chemistry at the University of Ottawa, on the line with us. We're talking about the future of energy and their work on converting ethanol into butanol, a much, hopefully, a more efficient and a better kind of fuel, and the work that they're doing. And they're doing a good job of getting me to sort of gear back and not overpromise. But it is an exciting development, and that's what we're talking about when we come back on our monthly Science Roundtable. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Maggie Brooks has moved from the county executive's office to a new job at RTS, a six-figure job that didn't even exist before. Some call it political patronage. Maggie Brooks says the media has been unfair to her. Our first hour media roundtable will examine just how we cover so-called political patronage. That and more Tuesday on Connections.
What if we could use fossil fuels without putting all that carbon into the atmosphere?
Bring the carbon up, use it, and put it back is the basic idea.
To fight climate change, researchers are exploring ways to trap carbon down here on Earth.
I can't wait to see what great minds come up with to reimagine CO2.
Technological approaches to climate change, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Interesting, All Things Considered, going to be talking about technological approaches to climate change. To some degree, you know, when you talk about alternative energy and biofuels, et cetera, that's a technological approach to climate change, our energy needs. And when corn-based ethanol was the government's favorite alternative energy at the moment 10, 12 years ago, especially in this state, and certainly with a lot of the corn being grown in the Midwest and Iowa, there was a lot of talk about it being a benefit in a lot of different ways, to energy maybe prices, to using less gasoline, more energy independence. But there were a lot of impacts that did not turn out to be so good. Farmers who were subsidized stopped rotating crops. There was a negative effect on the soil. Some said it ended up being worse environmentally than gasoline itself. It impacted commodity prices, and corrosive for your car as well. So if we can change that, if we can make it more efficient, if you can turn ethanol into butanol and do it better, well, that is the direction we'd love to see it happen. And that's what Bill Jones and Tom Baker are talking about. They're my guests here today on the Monthly Science Roundtable. I want to get to the first phone call, and Jim in Geneva is first up. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, hello. Interesting show. I'm kind of coming from a unique perspective. I am a corn grower here in New York State, and my family also has a business where we sell luxury vehicles. You know, and I guess the first point, some of the claims of the engine damage, I think, are overstated. I drive a very expensive pickup truck, and I willingly use E85 that I have for a number of years, and no problems. I know some other farmer friends that do that, so that's not a scientific observation. But the other point that I have is I keep hearing that we want to use, or the stover left from the corn is waste. And from a soil conservation standpoint, that is in no way waste. That if we were to remove the entire corn plant, that would be a really bad thing, from both from an erosion standpoint and the recycling nutrients into the soil. And I guess I have a problem with that, with stover being called waste.
All right, Jim, stay on the line with us, and let's let our guests respond. Yeah. I'll start with Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's not, in terms of the stover itself, it has several components. It's got cellulose, which is the sugar chains that we would like to use to recapture for their fuel value. But then there's the lignocellulose, and then the lignin itself. And the lignin, I think you're right, could be used to plow back into the soil to use for soil erosion purposes. I don't think the entire stover you know, it would be treated as waste. Some of that is a value, has cellulose, which has valuable fuel value. And that's the part, I think, that we'd like to use to make the ethanol.
Tom?
Yeah, this is also true for wheat straw. And for almost any crop, you have to leave a certain amount of the crop waste on the ground in order to keep the soil health as you want it. But as Bill said, you also have the possibility of processing some of that material and then returning some of the other nutrients back to the soil that aren't used in the sugar process. I think the caller's point is certainly well taken and well known by those who are knowledgeable about farming.
And Jim, when it comes to corn, being someone who's farmed corn, and your thoughts on corn-based ethanol, you know, do you dispute any other sort of the negative shade that it's received over the years for these various reasons we've been discussing, or what are your views on corn-based ethanol?
Well, I do agree there's some problems with it, but number one, the corn doesn't just disappear. You know, there's still the distiller's grain that comes up. That's used on a lot of farms as a feed source. There's a CO2 that comes up that's used in industry. There's more, you know, the corn doesn't just disappear once the sugar is taken out to make the ethanol. And that sometimes, I think, it doesn't get mentioned. I know there's a lot of negativity towards the ethanol, but I think that it's kind of one-sided the way it's presented, the problems. And again, back to the soil conservation, all chemistry aside, it's just the corn stover acts as a physical barrier for the raindrops that hit the soil. You know, we do these calculations with USDA, and each field has got a little, you know, sort of a mini management plan, and a field that has a certain amount of slope to it, where you're required to leave the stover on just to break the impact of the raindrops and, you know, keep our soils from washing into the lakes.
Okay. Well, Jim, thanks for the phone call. I would just say, yeah, I don't.
Could I just ask the caller about?
Oh, sure.
The corn,
yeah, go ahead,
cob?
Tom. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
What does he think about the corn cobs? I know those are mostly used now for animal feed, but you know, what's the economics of that? Do you think?
Well, corn cobs in general, they don't use those for feed too much anymore. They at one point in history they were. But the dairy farmers actually harvest the entire plant, and more they're not required, but they're very, very much encouraged and actually being paid to put cover crops down when the corn is removed and, you know, is harvested in September. But grain is a whole different thing. You leave the vast majority of the biomass stays in the field and it covers the field, it protects it from erosion. And, you know, we can actually grow corn on steeper slopes if we don't remove the entire plant.
Okay.
Answer your
question.
I was just asking, Tom, does that answer your question?
I just wanted to know, you know, when you make the ethanol from the corn starch, what happens to the cob in general? Yeah.
Well, the cob stays in the field. The combine separates the cob from the grain. The cob.
Oh, okay, right in the field. Okay, I didn't know that. Thank
you. Yeah, they still. A lot of times, you'll see pictures of, you know, somebody will put up a picture of agriculture and they'll show an old corn picker picking just the cobs and putting them in a wagon. That method is gone. That was gone in the early '60s, probably. So cobs generally stay in the field unless the corn is harvested for silage. In that case, the farmer uses the entire plant.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate the phone call, and a good reminder that the media sometimes has to update its stock photo file in the way we're depicting. But he did mention he's kind of disputing, just anecdotally in his own experience, Bill, this idea of automobile and vehicle corrosion through the ethanol. He's saying he hasn't noticed it himself, but... You know, he's not a scientific experiment, and you're just saying scientifically there is more corrosion in vehicles with more ethanol.
And probably depends on the type of vehicle. I mean, the flex fuel vehicles were designed specifically to accommodate the fact that they were using a more corrosive fuel. But the original design engines, they didn't have this so that when you started to use ethanol as an additive to the fuel, there was damage. So it's definitely something the industry can engineer around, but they need to know what the parameters are that they're working with. How much ethanol, how much water will be in the fuel? What are the assumptions that they're going by when they manufacture the vehicles? And there's a cost associated with that if you change the engineering.
All right. James, another listener, writes a two-part question. He said, first of all, is the work from your panelists going to cut gas prices or energy prices? Bill?
So I don't think so. I would imagine the price of the gasoline will be set by the other market forces. What this will do would be to take ethanol and make it a value-added product. So if ethanol sells for $2 a gallon, butanol you might be able to sell for $3 a gallon. So you've increased the value of the raw materials that you have. And that's where I could see a benefit from, a financial benefit from the process that we're talking about.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the price of gasoline is a very complex equation. You know, oftentimes, which we have no control over, even the oil companies sometimes have no control over, as it's a geopolitical, you know, situation. And so as Bill said, all we can do is try and say, okay, if we're going with the ethanol, how can we, and if our technology is allowing us to make the ethanol from the renewable feedstocks, you know, from a wide variety of renewable feedstocks, how are we then going to upgrade that ethanol to the next, you know, product that's going to be of value, both as a fuel and as a chemical feedstock?
All right, so before I get to the second part of James's question, let's talk best case scenario. Bill, we have been, you know, talking about the need not to overpromise here, but with the research that's been happening and the work that you're doing on this project, what is the best case scenario? I don't know if it's, you know, a year or 5 or 10 down the line, but whatever it is, what do you think is the best case scenario?
So let's suppose the system we've developed, there is a three-step process, and our big breakthrough was in step two. That's the selectivity step that I mentioned. So let's assume that step we've solved. We still need to get steps one and step three to work efficiently and inexpensively. And, you know, ideally, if you could find a heterogeneous catalyst that would do those two steps and combine it with the catalyst that we've developed for the second step, you could begin to see a process in a couple of years, I think, that could be developed from this.
Okay. And we'd start to see, you know, those of us listening who are not in your line of work would see the impact. If this happens, again, best case scenario, what do we start to see?
I think it's several years down the line.
Okay.
Because you need the basic discovery, first of all, of what catalyst is going to work under the conditions and not be degraded. And then you need to do all the engineering to put this three-step process together. And I think what would happen is that I would envision this processing unit being attached or sitting next door to an ethanol-producing facility. So the ethanol, as soon as it was produced, would be fed directly into this type of a system.
And then by the time it arrives at a gas station, et cetera, it's butanol.
Yep.
And again, better for the engine, better for our vehicles, a more efficient product, more mild, better everything, I would think.
Lower volatility, so you're not evaporating, lower corrosiveness, higher energy content as well.
Okay, Tom, what is the best case scenario in your mind?
Well, I think a lot of it really does depend on how we continue to handle hydrocarbons as our fuel source. Because with a renewable feedstock, what we're saying is that the plant itself removes the CO2 from the air, and we process it to get our fuel. And then when we burn our fuel, we make the CO2, which is then going to be in turn captured by the plant in the next cycle. So that's how you have a renewable process. Right now, if you ask that process to compete with hydrocarbons, where we irreversibly take that hydrocarbon and convert it to CO2 and water without any need to recover the CO2 or do anything, it's not really fair. Okay, and so that makes it a very difficult situation, and that's why a lot of politicians are thinking about a carbon tax. Now, whenever you say carbon tax, we always worry about our fuel's price going up, as we obviously have to worry about that because the economic progress is based on low energy costs. But it just seems fair in order to have to take some penalty for making that CO2, and that would allow then. Speaking with regard to your afternoon program on CO2 utilization, that would also really boost the research on the utilization of CO2 and how can we use some of that CO2 to make more useful products and more ameliorate our one-way kind of a production of CO2 from hydrocarbons.
All right, and the other part of James's question was just on where this is going to happen. So, Billy, I heard you just mention that in the best-case scenario, you've got an ethanol plant and essentially attached to it
Yes. Is
the technology to change the butanol right there on site.
Right.
And that, again, that's down the line, but that's potentially the way you would envision this happening.
Yes, so we actually were talking with a local company, Sweetwater, and mm-hmm. met with them just to see, well, what are their design parameters and constraints? So they currently produce ethanol, and it's in aqueous solution at about 10% concentration. So ideally, what they said, if you could take that as your feedstock, ethanol in water, and convert that into the butanol, that would be a highly valuable process. So again, if we could design a catalyst system that tolerated water, 90% water is the solvent. That would be a breakthrough because now we would directly convert this existing ethanol stream into butanol without having to do a separation step. And that could be done right there at the plant where they produce the ethanol.
Well, let's talk a little bit before the hour closes then on what this kind of multi-platform energy future really might look like with Bill Jones and Tom Baker. Bill, a professor of chemistry at the University of Rochester, Tom, professor of chemistry at the University of Ottawa, working on this research regarding ethanol and butanol. But, you know, Sue was asking earlier, one of our listeners was asking earlier just about how much does this really change in the landscape of what's happening? And, Jake was talking about, well, if we're going to use ethanol, we ought to make it as efficient as we can, but should we be looking at solar, wind, et cetera? And if both of our guests have said, of course we should be doing that. We should be walking and chewing gum at the same time. But Tom, I want to start with you when it comes to our needs, really societally. The work that you're doing right now, I think you're going to have some people like Jake who say, shouldn't we be going full bore into whatever the next generation is? But I think, Tom, and I wonder if you agree, that part of the confusion about an energy future is whatever is next isn't going to be one thing. You know, Adam Frank at the University of Rochester likes to say in 1890, there were no gas stations, and 30 years later, they were on every corner. And we did this big infrastructure change, and it was very clear on where the future of transportation was going. And I don't necessarily know that there's any one thing that would replace fossil fuels, supplant it. And that's why I think some people are having trouble picturing it, because it might be little slices here and little slices there. What do you see?
I think you're absolutely correct. It's a sociological change that we're going to have to evolve into, because as you said, you know, this has been the hydrocarbons have been just a boon for mankind. They've enabled the development of our civilization, but we have to worry now about what are our grandchildren going to do, you know,
and their grandchildren.
You know, when it gets harder and harder to get all these hydrocarbons. And eventually, society is going to demand that that the hydrocarbon loop, if it's going to be used, is going to be closed ecologically. So the CO2 will have to be reprocessed into the hydrocarbon, which is a difficult and energy-intensive process. And so I think that it's hard for us to imagine. Not living in a hydrocarbon future. There's no doubt about that, because that's what we've had. That's what all of our lives have been that, and our children's lives are going to be that. But when you start to get into their children and their children's children, this is not going to be an option. And so they're going to have to come up with some new technologies, and like you said, As many technologies as we can look at, it is going to give us the most flexibility in being successful at allowing everybody to have the energy and the that's needed for their lives.
Bill?
Yeah, I mean, philosophically, I agree. And in the end, we're going to want to recycle carbon dioxide. And the only really energy source we have that's renewable is the sun. So ultimately, the problem that will need to be solved is carbon dioxide plus sunlight to a fuel. And if we can do that, that's a real holy grail. Butanol is easy compared to CO2 to a liquid fuel. And there are a lot of people thinking about this. There's a lot of fundamental research going on right now where people are trying to do that, take atmospheric levels of CO2 and convert it into a fuel. So people are starting to think about that, and there is funding that's starting to be put towards that. But there's a long way to go till we get anything realistic there.
To state the obvious, that is miles beyond solar panels.
Yes.
We talk about solar,
absolutely.
That is not, yeah.
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 Yeah, solar panels make electricity. This
not
is something where
fuel.
You would harness
liquid
the light
yeah.
energy itself. The photons would be harnessed to drive a chemical reaction backwards or into a more energetic state. CO2 is one of the most inert molecules you can imagine. It doesn't do much of anything in terms of a reaction. We need to reduce that back to something more like a hydrocarbon and use that as an ultimate fuel.
Well, Bill, you and I will not be here in 100 years, but this show will be, because this show is an institution. So 100 years from now, is that going to be, do you think that will exist?
I think so, because I don't see any other way. There is no other energy source.
That's an interesting point.
Other than sunlight.
So you're saying it may not be easy to envision how you get there, but we have such a need for it that we will find a way to innovate it because it is vital to our survival.
Either that or we won't be here.
Well, I don't mean to laugh at that. But how interesting. Tom, what do you think?
Well, I think the carbon energy sources that we use now have the benefit of a high energy and a high volumetric density. One of the alternatives that's being considered is hydrogen as a fuel. And the reason this is attractive is because it can be produced from sunlight and water. And so from sunlight and water, we can generate hydrogen and oxygen. In a fuel cell, we can burn the hydrogen and oxygen to generate the, and so there's really, it's using water and sunlight, both of which, if we don't have, we're not alive anyway as a civilization. And the benefit to this is that you don't put carbon particulates into the air, which is one of the downsides of our carbon-based fuel system. But again, as Bill says, there's a lot of science that has to go into making this a reality. Obviously, the downside of hydrogen is it's a gas, and so it's not volumetrically a dense fuel. Even though energy-wise it's very dense, as far as the amount of volume that fuel takes up, it's not, because it's a gas. And so there's big challenges there as well, but I think we're going to see advances in both the hydrocarbon energy system and the hydrogen energy system in the coming decades.
Tom, as I get ready to wrap the hour, let me draw on some of your industry background with one more question then. To that point that Adam Frank makes about going from, the 1890s and horse and carriages to gas stations on every corner, and knowing that our energy future isn't going to be quite that simple, and it may be more multi-platform and not as easy to envision right now. I wonder if that is what is driving, or at least causing someone stagnation, that because people can't see it, there's not one thing that's going to be easy and profitable. But I'm hoping that for example, the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and other groups we talk to, I'm hoping they're right when they say whatever it is, whether it's butanol and more solar and all of these things that are happening, that it is profitable, that industry embraces it and wants to innovate with it as opposed to resisting it. What's your perspective from the industry side on that?
Well, I think it's related to the whole concept of green chemistry. I mean, when we talk about green chemistry, which is a major driving force in the manufacturing industry right now, You know, we always talk about how can we substitute non-toxic, our solvents with safer solvents, et cetera. But the underlying thing is, if you can't make more money doing those substitutions, that they're not going to happen. And so the green movement includes the dollar signs of green. There's no doubt.
Yeah, and Bill, you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Yeah. It might be a better process, but if it's not more profitable, it's not going to happen. They won't adopt it. That's a business decision.
We'll sneak one more question, and David just says, I heard your guests refer to a bridge fuel a couple of times. In my view, bridge fuel has come to be a pejorative. I feel like it's an excuse to keep doing something related to carbon. Is bridge fuel a pejorative now, Bill? Is it?
Perhaps, because you're talking about you're only going to use this temporarily, and then you're going to be moving on to something else. Why not go after that target right from the start? And I kind of agree that it would be good to do that. But to me, butanol has value, as I've mentioned, as more than just a fuel. In essence, a fuel is the least valuable thing you can use anything for. We're just going to burn it. We give up. We don't know how else to use this material. Let's just burn it and get the energy out of it. And I'd like to see processes like the ethanol to butanol process be used beyond just the fuel value for producing the C4 from the C2.
Okay. Tom, some final words from you on that subject?
Well, I think, you know, I don't really see the bridge fuel as being pejorative, because it's a matter of the technology has to rely on the breakthroughs in science. And if the breakthroughs have not yet happened, the technology cannot advance. And so so much of it is about timing. And we've seen this in the IT area. I mean, just look at the difference we have now. First we had internet, now we have iPhones and iWatches, and all this has really happened from advances in the electronics industry. I mean, you couldn't have had an iPhone, when Apple wanted to develop the iPod, they couldn't do it because the technology didn't exist. And all of a sudden, a company in Japan came up with the smaller chip, and then wham, you're able to do that technology, and it didn't take long.
Well, and I got to jump in, and we're out of time, but to Tom's point, it's a great point. Nobody knows the exact moment where we would need exactly the next technology or fuel. Maybe that's why bridges are needed. It's fascinating to hear about the work. And Tom Baker from the University of Ottawa. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for your time this hour.
Well, thanks very much.
Bill Jones, professor of chemistry, University of Rochester. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
Valerie LaBanca, engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is our monthly Science Roundtable on Connections.